From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, The Witch's Brew, with Fiona Horn and later on, Christian Day. A couple of witches. Well, Iran has test-fired a long-range missile in response to what it says are threats from Israel and the United States. Here's a quote now from their commander of their Revolutionary Guard. "We want to tell the world that those who conduct their foreign policy by using the language of threat against Iran have to know that our finger is always on the trigger and that we have hundreds and even thousands of missiles ready to be fired against predetermined targets." Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps test-fired a Shahab-3 missile and several other missiles during war games in the Persian Gulf called the Great Prophet 3. In a moment, we'll check in with WorldNet Daily's Jerry Corsi about the possibility of war with Iran. The Senate has just approved a bill that will overhaul rules on terrorist surveillance while giving the Bush administration a win that it had sought for months. That was legal immunity for telecommunications companies that helped in its secret eavesdropping program. They gave information to the government. More than 1,000 people now are confirmed ill from the salmonella, initially linked to raw tomatoes, a grim milestone that makes this the worst foodborne outbreak in at least a decade. Now, adding to the confusion, the government is now warning certain people to avoid types of hot peppers as well. Certain tomatoes, they say, the raw ones, Red Round, Plum, and Roma, remain a chief suspect, and the government stressed again that all consumers, that's you, should avoid them unless they were harvested in areas clear to suspicion. But people at highest risk of severe illness from the salmonella also should not eat raw jalapeno and serrano peppers, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The raw jalapenos caused some of the illness, concluding the CDC investigators of two clusters of sick people who ate at the same restaurant or catered event. Officials cleared the immediate family of JonBenet Ramsey in her death, thanks to new DNA evidence that links the murder to a still unknown man. Boulder, Colorado District Attorney Mary Lacey gave John Ramsey a letter that stated that significant new evidence convinces us that it is appropriate, given the circumstances of this case, to state that we do not consider your immediate family, including you, your wife Patsy, and your son Burke, to be under any suspicion in the commission of this crime. Patsy, by the way, died in 2006. JonBenet Ramsey, a six-year-old beauty contestant, was found dead in her family's Boulder home on December 26, 1996. She had been reported missing earlier in the morning and was found by her father, John, in the family's basement. She had been strangled and bludgeoned and had signs of sexual molestation. Psychiatrists have detected the very first case of climate change delusion. Writing in the Australian and New Zealand Journal of Psychiatry, Joshua Wolf and Robert Sallow of the Royal Children's Hospital say this delusion was a previously unreported phenomenon. A 17-year-old man was referred to the inpatient psychiatric unit at Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne with an 8-month history of depressed mood. He also had visions of apocalyptic events. The patient had also developed the belief that due to climate change, his own water consumption would lead within days to the deaths of millions of people through exhaustion of water supplies, and he just can't take it. Scientists have an important advance in their efforts to predict earthquakes. A team of U.S. researchers has detected stress-induced changes in rocks that occurred hours before two small tremors in California's San Andreas Fault. The observations use sensors lowered down holes drilled in the quake zone. The team says that they're a long way from routine tremor forecasts, but the latest findings hold out hope that such services might be possible one day. They simply say if we can give people a 10-hour warning, that could save a lot of lives. Jim Berkland, of course, is right on with his predictions. Water has been found conclusively for the very first time inside ancient moon samples brought back by the Apollo astronauts. The discovery may force scientists to rethink the lunar past and future, although uncertainty remains about how much water exists and whether future explorers could extract it. I think they'll find out the moon was part of planet Earth and just broke off after a collision billions of years ago. A Japanese labor bureau has reported that one of Toyota's very top car engineers died from working too many hours. The latest in a string of such findings in a nation where extraordinarily long hours for some employees has long been the norm. The man who died was aged 45 and had been under severe pressure as the lead engineer in developing a hybrid version of Toyota's blockbuster Camry line. In the 2 months up to his death, the man averaged more than 80 hours of overtime per month. So in this era where you need to make some money, be careful how many hours you work. Procedures at an Iowa hospital are under review now following the death of a patient who was trapped in a hospital elevator for nearly 3 hours. Officials at the Mary Greeley Medical Center in Des Moines say a 34-year-old woman died after being brought to intensive care from the emergency room. They thought that she had been stabilized, but she died a short time later after apparently being stuck in that elevator for the 3 hours. A Russian woman in St. Petersburg killed her drunk husband with a folding couch. The man's wife, upset with her husband for being drunk and refusing to get up, kicked a handle after an argument, activating a mechanism that folds the couch up against the wall. Well, the couch, which doubles as a bed, folds up automatically in order to save space. The man fell between the mattress and the back of the couch. The woman then walked out of the room, returned 3 hours later to check on her very quiet, sleeping husband. He was dead. A British woman who broke her ankle and needed surgery because her stiletto heel snapped off has received a $14,400 cash award from a British court because of her pain and suffering. A Manchester court ordered the store to pay Sophie King, whose ankle still swells painfully 3 years later after her operation. She told the court that she was wearing the black strappy shoes for the very first time for a night out on the town with her friends when the heel snapped off, sending her sprawling onto the pavement. She said she was able to carry on, but collapsed later on that night and had to be hospitalized. And I got this fast blast in late last night, right after we went off the air. You know how Bill Nell was talking about the story of Jackie Gleason and Gleason's witnessing of some extraterrestrials at an Air Force base down in Florida. Listen to this one from John in California. It says, George, I'd like to confirm the Gleason story. A friend for 25 years, Glenn Maxwell, married to June Allison, the movie star, knew Gleason very well. And one night at a restaurant, having dinner, all four of them, in L.A., he relayed the same story about Jackie Gleason telling him about seeing these extraterrestrials. Man, it's got to be true. Well, in a moment, Jerry Corsi joins us. We're going to talk about the possibility of war with Iran. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Jerome Corsi received a Ph.D. from Harvard University in political science in 1972. He's written many books. He's an expert on political violence and terrorism. In 1981, he received a top secret clearance from the Agency for International Development. He has assisted in providing anti-terrorism hostage survival training. He is writing now for WorldNet Daily as well, as long as his own books. And he's got another one coming out in the near future, also writing a new newsletter we'll tell you about a little bit later on this hour. Jerry Corsi. Hey, Jerry, how are you?
I'm great, George. Great to be with you. Thank you.
Well, this feeling that all of us have felt for the last several months, I think, is getting closer and closer. As a matter of fact, I got a very confidential email from a guest who's been on the program before, and I can't mention his name, and he said that he believes prophecy has kicked in and something is going to happen. Jerry, it looks like all the signs, unless heads prevail here, all the signs are pointing that something's going to happen between Israel and Iran, with the United States being forced to come into it. And I want to get your take on it this hour.
Well, George, I think you're exactly right. The tension in the Middle East is ramping up fast. I mean, with the firing today of these missiles, or it was actually on Wednesday, they fired the missiles in Iran and broadcast the firing on television. It was a clear sign, especially firing that Shahab 3 that could go 1,250 miles and easily hit Tel Aviv. It was a clear sign by Iran that they're going to be antagonistic. They're going to be, you know, any attack on them is going to be met with a counterattack that will be disastrous to Israel, to our troops in the region, to our ships in the Gulf. I mean, this is a belligerent regime that is showing its, you know, belligerence at a time when it's only going to add fuel to the fire of the tensions in the Middle East.
No doubt about that. In Farsi, what does Shahab mean? Do you know, Jerry?
It means skyrocket. It means the shooting star. And the Shahab 3 is a missile that is really, I think, the most advanced of the missiles that Iran has. It was based on a Korean design. But like almost everything Iran does, they take weapons from elsewhere, or they take all kinds of things from elsewhere and re-engineer them. It's like I've been writing for going back 2 years, predicting that Iran would take the centrifuges, the P-2s. They got the designs of the advanced centrifuges from A.Q. Khan and his, you know, the radical Pakistani nuclear scientist who was running a black market operation in the Middle East on nuclear secrets. And Iran re-engineers these, you know, the P-2. They re-engineered one. I think they probably got the best P-2 design in the world. They did the same with the Chinese cruise missile that they bought, and they re-engineered it and used it in the war against Hezbollah. If you recall, George, they hit the Revolutionary Guard operating in Lebanon, worked to hit an Israeli ship with one of these cruise missiles in the Mediterranean, which was an incredible feat. I mean, the Israeli ships are about as well defended as any ships in the world, and if they could hit, you know, if the Revolutionary Guard could hit with one of these new cruise missiles and an Israeli ship in the Mediterranean, they can hit our ships in the Gulf. And I think I keep saying that a war in the Middle East would be against Iran would be the worst possible outcome. It would radicalize the people in Iran against the United States. Right now, the people in Iran are largely oppressed by this regime and favorable to the United States. These missiles that Iran has, even with conventional warheads, could kill thousands in Israel, thousands of U.S. troops, could damage U.S. ships. They could shut down the Gulf of Hormuz, which could probably send oil doubling in price overnight. I mean, if you think, you know, if we think that $4, you know, going to $5 is a lot to pay for gasoline, how about, you know, $9 or $10 a gallon for gasoline? That's what a war with Iran could easily mean. So the consequences of war, it's not a video game. You know, we don't just press some buttons and send some cruise missiles in and destroy Iran's nuclear sites. These are sites that are very well protected. They're defended now with advanced Russian-built SA-20 surface-to-air missile systems that can knock down cruise missiles and fighter planes. It's a, you know, but the entire situation is ramping up. Israel has also run exercises, running airplanes out into the Mediterranean,
right,
showing that they could go as far as hitting Iran. I mean, both sides are ramping up, ready to go to war with each other.
I do not think, this is my gut, you tell me how you feel about this. You're the Iranian expert here. I do not think Israel is going to permit Iran to fire off a volley of, as the Iranians say, hundreds if not thousands of missiles. They said today they will make Tel Aviv burn and they will go after U.S. interests and ships in the Persian Gulf. I do not think Israel will permit those missiles to be fired without using what they have, and that is a nuclear arsenal.
Well, George, I think that's a very good analysis because Israel does have a nuclear arsenal, and you know, even Jimmy Carter recently, I think, revealed the exact number of weapons they have, which is something like 140 nuclear warheads. They've also got tactical nuclear warheads. Israel is not going to sit by and idly allow Iran to become more and more dangerous with any day waking up and Iran could launch some kind of a missile attack against Israel. And as Iran continues to enrich uranium, despite offers from the United Nations to have Russia provide all the uranium that Iran could need for peaceful purposes, the regime and Ahmadinejad, the president, have insisted that Iran has the right to continue enriching uranium. Now that they've got over 3,000 P-2 centrifuges in place in Natanz, they're ramping up to the point where they could, within a year, produce enough highly enriched uranium to produce a weapon, nuclear bomb, even a low-grade atomic bomb of the Hiroshima class could destroy Tel Aviv. Take one weapon. It's a, you know, Israel's a one-bomb state. One nuclear weapon of low grade that detonated over Tel Aviv would largely destroy the modern Jewish state as we know it. And that's the risk that Israel runs, even with advanced anti-missile systems, even with our anti-missile systems. You can't handle a barrage of Shahab 3s fired simultaneously on Tel Aviv. One would certainly get through. So, you know, the nightmare is that Iran produces two or three nuclear warheads and launches them any day on Tel Aviv. And as that clock ticks, it's not there yet, but is it going to be there, you know, at the end of this year, sometime in 2009? These are the unknowns as Iran continues to enrich uranium.
And the Russians are saying that they will use some kind of military or technical intervention if the U.S. continues with its Eastern European missile defense program. What's going to happen there?
Well, and again, that's a very dangerous situation. We heard today Secretary of Defense Gates saying that these missile launches in Iran were justification, further justification for the Czech Republic putting in these new anti-missile defense systems, which Russia has objected to as, you know, threatening Russian interests. What kind of missile? What kind of response Russia could take? Russia would have many options. They've already put missile defense systems in Iran. They could put more aggressive systems within Iran, assist Iran, or assist some of their satellite countries that are still active to have more weapon systems deployed within them. I'm sure the Ukraine would listen to a Russian overture to put more weapon systems within the Ukraine. There's others of the countries around, you know, the new republics that have formed after the Soviet Union broke up that would be receptive to those overtures. What we're seeing is a ramp up in the escalation of threat and violence in the Middle East. And we shouldn't forget Hezbollah, which has thousands of rockets pointed at Israel from Lebanon, or Hamas in the Gaza Strip, which continues to dominate the Palestinian Authority and has continued to swear to eliminate the Jewish state in Israel.
Why doesn't Iran simply say, okay, we're going to disband our nuclear power ambitions, and we're going to go solar, or we're going to do this, and we're going to do that, and we're going to move ahead of all of you with alternative energy, even though we're a major producer of oil? Why don't they do something like that?
Well, that's been the overtures from the United Nations. I mean, I think you've exactly phrased, George, what the diplomatic initiatives have been to Iran to say, look, we as the world will cooperate with you, Iran, to have nuclear power. You know, we'll give you all the uranium you need from Russia to run a nuclear peaceful power operation within Iran. Iran wants to be a nuclear state. It's the, you know, the badge of distinction that Iran sees to be a regional power, and the regional power for Iran would extend into Western Europe, because the reach of Iran's missiles reaches into Western Europe. And certainly to be the first Islamic nuclear-powered state, even the Saudis, I think, are right now in fear that Iran will achieve its objectives. These missile strikes were not only – these missile tests in this demonstration that were done on Wednesday by Iran were not only frightening to Israel, they were frightening as well to Saudi Arabia.
Do you believe that if Iran had the capability of building a nuclear weapon – do you believe they would actually use it?
Yes, George, I do. I mean, this is the – you've got to look at the Islamic Republic as terrorists. They have been this radical regime. Remember, Ahmadinejad has even proclaimed at the United Nations. He believes the Mahdi is going to return, this 12th Imam, the holy figure that went down the well in 957 A.D. or whatever year it was. And it's going to come out of the well in a glorious – you know, like a messiah, and when he does, Shiite Islam will triumph worldwide. The problem is that Ahmadinejad and this particular brand of Shiite Islam believes it will take an apocalypse. Apocalypse will have to happen in order to cause the Mahdi to come out of the well. And I've said repeatedly, I wrote it in Atomic Iran, that terrorists do not stockpile weapons. When they get a weapon, they use it. They're worried somebody's going to take it away from them.
Yeah, that's true. You need to get an interview with Ahmadinejad for WorldNet Daily and sit him down and ask him what he has said and why he has said it. And I'll tell you why, because someone sent me an article from an Arabic newspaper, Jerry, that said that Ahmadinejad was totally misquoted, that he doesn't want to annihilate Israel. He wants a regime change in Israel, much like people would like an administrative change, let's say, during election years. I want to ask you about that when we come back. Plus, we'll open up the phone lines for Jerry Corsi. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, it's the Witch's Brew. We'll start it with Fiona Horn. Next up, though, it's Jerry Corsi and your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. We're with Jerry Corsi. Jerry, have you tried yet to get an interview with Ahmadinejad?
No, it's a great idea. I'd love to do it. I think it would be, I'm not sure how much benefit would come of the interview. George, remember, Ahmadinejad appeared on 60 Minutes with Mike Wallace.
Mm-hmm.
And that was probably the one interview that...
He was powder puffed in that interview.
He was. Well, Mike Wallace was in Tehran, and it was a powder puff interview. But I think you did see, I mean, Ahmadinejad is a brilliant guy. And he reminded me in talking about the grievances, you know, when he's talking about the Palestinians and the Lebanese and the Iraqis. You go back to Hitler talking in the 30s about the Sudetenland Germans or the grievances of the Germans living in Danzig. I mean, these were the same kinds of rantings. You've got to come down to the point where you realize that Ahmadinejad is a radical zealot. He truly does believe in this extreme Shiite Islam, you know, the Mahdi coming back, the Messiah figure, and the same as Ayatollah Khomeini did. And Ahmadinejad is not going to be persuaded by rhetoric or discussion or dialogue. The Iranians are pursuing nuclear power and enriching uranium because they want to. They've heard all the arguments of the world. They've been to the diplomatic meetings all over the world. They've listened to the International Atomic Energy Agency and the UN, and the Iranians are going to continue pursuing this objective because Ahmadinejad says he wants Israel out of the Middle East. He said move it to Europe. He went through this Holocaust denial. The Holocaust never happened. You know, move the Jews back into Europe. That'd be fine with him. He wants Israel wiped off the map, whether it's diplomatically or any other means, and the final analysis by war would be fine with him too.
Why can't they simply admit Israel was formed in 1948, it's there, and make it work, and try to do the best you can for the Palestinians and create peace? Why can't they do this?
It's just an obsession of the Middle East. When I was a kid, you know, Nasser and Egypt had the obsession. He was leading the charge against Israel. It was Sadat who basically from Egypt said, we're not going to do this anymore, and laid down the fight with Israel. Now it's not the Sunnis like Egypt or Saudi Arabia that's pursuing the war against Israel. They've pretty well resolved in Egypt and Saudi Arabia to live with Israel. Now it's the Shiites and Ahmadinejad in Iran who picked up the anti-Israel message and are pursuing it with a single-mindedness that becomes an obsession. The Middle East has been, since 1948, obsessed with eliminating Israel. And, you know, even if you did eliminate Israel, it would not stop the zealots in Iran because they would immediately turn on the Sunnis.
And there's no doubt the Palestinians got the short end of the stick in 48. I mean, somehow the United Nations, in their push to establish a Jewish state, should have done something for the displaced Palestinians who lost their homes and properties and things while all this was going on. Nobody did anything for them now. I can understand how they feel. I really can. They're living in deplorable conditions. But the fact is, Israel's there now, and it's been there for 60 years, and it's time to make everything work.
Well, and George, the world is moving towards a two-state solution in the Middle East and with regards to the Palestinians and the Israelis. The problem is that you've still got radical elements in Hezbollah and Hamas and Iran who do not accept the part of the equation that says Israel is going to continue to exist.
No, they don't.
They don't accept that. And you've got to get your mind around having, you know, I've been to the Middle East many times, and you finally just realize that there is this radical element. Right now, the banner carried by the Shiite Islam radicals in Iran that refuse to accept the state of Israel.
Well, and one of the reasons, Yuri, they believe still that that land is theirs.
Well, there's, you know, George, and going back and going centuries back and trying to resolve these historical problems is never a solution.
No.
You've got to look at Egypt and Sadat, you know, Sadat and Rabin, and I continue to go back, and I was very moved with Leah Rabin, Rabin's wife, after he was assassinated, gave a speech that I attended in New York, in which she said, you know, her husband, at the end of his life, had reached the point where he realized that war was the problem in the Middle East. It was not the solution. Every time someone was killed in anger in the Middle East in an Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it generated another generation of hate, another generation of war, and war was not going to solve anything. I continue to believe that about a war with Iran. It will not fundamentally solve anything.
I promise phone calls, and please mention the newsletter before we go off this hour, Jerry, the new work you're doing with WorldNet Daily. East of the Rockies, John in Tennessee. Take it away. Hey, John.
It's an honor, gentlemen, to both of you to speak with y'all. I've got a question and a quick comment. My question is if he did something like this by attacking Israel, what would he have to gain besides nothing? What would he would have to gain is a concrete country, because we would absolutely turn him into a concrete country. You know what I mean?
Yep, there's no doubt about that.
There's no reason for him to do this. So see, what's going on is you got Dick Cheney, your John Bolton's running around saying this stuff, because they know the simple reason is they've made a bigger Iraq now. They gave Iraq to Iran because Maliki now is cozying up to Iran, and now they don't like it. And he's wanting us out of his country now. That's the problem.
What do you think of this observation, Jerry?
Well, there's a lot of validity in what the caller's saying. I mean, first of all, the long-term solution to the Middle East does not include the United States being an active and continuing participant. But if we're going to, any administration, including the Bush administration, that thinks we need a permanent role in Iraq or anywhere else in the Middle East is wrong. That's not going to be accepted. It's not in the cards. And trying to force a presence in the Middle East is not a solution either. The whole idea of Iraq saying to us they want a withdrawal schedule is something that we really ought to take a look at and set that withdrawal schedule. I don't think we need a permanent position in Iraq, and I don't think we need to settle out the grievances between Iraq and Iran. Remember, there was a 10-year war, an 8-year war, really, in the 1980s between Iraq and Iran, and by eliminating Saddam Hussein, Iran legitimately can conclude we really won that war for Iran. And Iran, there's a lot of Shiites in Iran and Iraq, I mean, in Iraq, that have close ties with the Shiites who are the predominant force within Iran. We're not going to settle these issues out. These are hundreds of years old in these conflicts, and we're not going to settle it out. I think we'd be best to see if we could get a two-state solution and preserve Israel, to get the Shiites ultimately to accept Israel, just as Egypt ultimately accepted Israel. That would be a huge breakthrough if it could be achieved, but it will not be achieved through a permanent presence by the United States in the Middle East.
Merlin in Illinois, you're on with Dr. Jerry Corsi. Go ahead, Merlin.
Yes, hi, good evening. I'm Merlin, phoning from Chicago. A couple things. One, you mentioned, George, that you had received some information that the president of Iran misspoke and said he wants to see, say, a regime change, and that the physical destruction of Israel, and then you went on to ask your guest, well, why not interview him and so on. So I think that would be something to take a look at to see if he really did misspeak. That's my first comment. Secondly, I'm wondering, and your guest could give me his opinion, who do you think would strike first? Do you think Israel might say, man, we better go in and throw the first preemptive strike against Iran? Or do you think Iran might get jittery and just go ahead and take a swing at Israel. And lastly, for you, George, I understand you'll be coming to Chicago.
Yes.
I appreciate some information on that, and I'm wondering if it's something the public could attend.
Yeah, absolutely. Merlin, if you would go to my website, there's a schedule of events, and I'll be in Chicago on the 19th. It's a Saturday and a part of a Sunday, but just go to the coasttocoastam.com website, okay?
I'll make sure we have nice weather for you.
Yeah, please. Well, it's not too far from St. Louis. Jerry, I'm going to quickly answer it, and then you. I do not believe Iran will take the first volley because they need public opinion on their side, and they are not going to look like the aggressor. Your take?
I agree with you, George. I think Iran right now is trying to make the point that it's going to defend itself. I think Iran's saying, look, if you want to go to war with us, don't think this is going to be simple. Don't think it's going to be over in a day, or don't think it's going to be with no casualties. A war with Iran is a prolonged and very difficult and very costly enterprise, and we should not enter it, neither should Israel, without a lot of consideration that it would be so costly it may be ultimately counterproductive, or we could lose. I mean, that Israel, I think, has been not wanting to go to war. Certainly the times I've been in Israel, the Israelis and government that I've met with at very high levels have been asking for a diplomatic solution. Israel does not have enthusiasm to go to war with Iran, and we shouldn't either.
See, I think the biggest concern, and that's where most of the media has missed the mark, Jerry, is I don't think there's a concern of Iran trying to nuke Israel whenever they get their nukes. That area is way too small for that. I mean, they'd both be devastated. I think the concern is that Iran gets nuclear weaponry, sells it to terrorists, and we wake up one morning, as Paul Williams believes, and find out that six U.S. cities are gone. Well, I think that's the real concern here, and nobody's talking about that.
In Atomic Iran, I wrote that entire scenario, that Iran would be able to make a weapon, would give it to terrorists, it would be brought in, you know, in containers through ports, assembled in the United States. I even wrote an entire scenario of what it would be to have a nuclear weapon detonated in New York City. Very frightening scenario, but I've foreseen that possibility as well. I think ultimately, George, Israel will not allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon. If Iran continues down this track, a war is inevitable. And I called it the Samson option in the Atomic Iran, that regardless of the consequences, Israel would strike Iran because it could not sit still and wait to be attacked. The fear which is there, also, I don't want to throw in the conversation, there is a suicidal element in the Shiite Islam radicalism. The Shiite radicals invented the suicide bombing. That comes from Iran. The Iranians, the apocalypse that Ahmadinejad...
Well, they've invented the suicide bomb as long as the person committing suicide is some young kid and not them.
Well,
I don't see Osama bin Laden flying planes into the World Trade Center.
Well, the mullahs certainly have put a lot of money into the United Arab Emirates and the banks, and the mullahs themselves look pretty fat and happy. They don't look like they're going to commit suicide either. But this suicidal element, I mean, the whole idea of the Mahdi coming back will be if an apocalypse occurs, the apocalypse has to occur first, and then the Mahdi comes back. It's not the other way around. It's the apocalypse is a precondition to the Mahdi returning.
Why do I still feel that the globalists want this to happen?
Well, certainly the push is there. I mean, John Bolton, whom your caller mentioned, has been saying, openly calling for the need for military action in order to stop Iran. And I think, the choice is not between a war or letting Iran develop nuclear weapons and attack Israel. There's a whole range of middle options here. We got South Africa to drop apartheid without any war. We got the Soviet Union to crumble without a war. There's a whole range of middle diplomatic measures that can be taken to prevent this kind of calamity from happening. I think a war with Iran would be a disaster. We've not fully explored all of the avenues, including supporting the Iranian expatriates who, there's a million or more Iranians in California. They're highly successful people. They're very good citizens. They love the United States and they love Iran. These are the kinds of people that want freedom in their own country. Let's support them. Let's support the freedom fighters within Iran. I still think if we made this conscious effort to support the freedom fighters in Iran, we could cause positive change in Iran even today.
It's a timetable. West of the Rockies, Mike in California. Go ahead, Mike.
George, you mentioned that prophecy was taking place. I truly believe that the War of Ezekiel pinpoints the Bear of the North, which is the former Soviet Union or Russia, mm-hmm. coming against mm-hmm. Israel or the Middle East there. And a third of that population of the world will be destroyed. You know, the sad part is that there's God-loving people in these countries. And Russia, we talk about Russia, but there's True. Christians in Russia, there's Christians in Iran and Iraq. But it seems like we're battling spiritual forces here. Now,
and even non-Christians, they're lovers of people.
Yeah, I walked 200 miles with the Iranians in 2005 from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C. in an Iran Freedom March. The people who were marching were all Islamic. These are people who want freedom. These are not, you know, people who are crazed to have war. The vast majority of Muslims around the world are peace-loving, want to raise their families and grow old and have economic security in their own lives and their children's lives and their grandchildren's
lives. Most people are, Jerry. The ones that aren't peace-loving are leaders of various nations who want to continue to upset the apple cart because of greed and everything else.
Well, that's true, George, and we've got to be sure that on our side, we don't beat the war drums thinking that it's going to be an easy solution. It's going to be a further problem in the Middle East. I can't say that enough times
to get that point across. Tell me about your newsletter, and if we have time for another call or two, we'll take it.
The newsletter is called Red Alert, George. I'm writing a newsletter on economics and politics with WorldNet Daily, worldnetdaily.com. You can see the newsletter there. It's a subscription newsletter, and I'm really giving some advanced predictions, some insights into the stock market, making specific predictions about the prices of oil, looking at the future of how politics are affecting the markets and an economic analysis. I've had 25 years working in banking and insurance around the world. I continue to have securities and insurance licenses. My PhD from Harvard is in political science, yet I've a large number of graduate economic courses, and my minor even in college was economics. I've always worked extensively in economics. This newsletter combines the economic analysis and the politics with a predictive element. Red Alert is called, the newsletter is called Red Alert. It's available on WorldNet Daily.
I understand there's a new book coming that you can't say much about that could upset an apple cart.
Yes, well, the book is going to be against Obama. It's called The Obama Nation. It's going to be published by Simon & Schuster in the first week of August. You can see it, George. It's previewed right now on Amazon.com. Just search my name, Jerome Corsi, C-O-R-S-I. Even the cover of the book has not been released yet. Simon & Schuster has the book under embargo, but will be, as we approach the last week in July and the first week in August, we'll be saying more about it. And it'll be in the bookstores all over the country. And remember, I was a co-author of Unfit for Command with John O'Neill.
The Swift Boat guy.
Yes, that's right. And this book on Obama, I think, you know, I'm very much anticipating it coming out in first week of August, The Obama Nation, Simon & Schuster.
All right, Jerry, I want to thank you for continuing to give us insight into this Iranian situation. And we will, of course, look at these events as they unfold and continue to tap into you as a resource. And let's just keep our fingers crossed and say a prayer that it doesn't blow up, but we'll be ready if it does, okay?
Always an honor and pleasure to be with you, and I continue to pray for peace in the Middle East.
I'll be back in a moment as we get into more of a classic Coast to Coast with Fiona Horn. The Witch's Brew, next on Coast to Coast AM.